This is the voice of the Vortex. Hello. Today is November 9th, 2010. I am not a fan of Jane Austen. I am not a fan of romance. I picked up Shades of Milk and Honey because it had Mary Robinette Kowal's name on it, and she has never failed to impress me. Shades of Milk and Honey was no different. The plot of Shades of Milk and Honey will be familiar to readers of Jane Austen. Sisters named Jane and Melody try to walk the narrow path that society has marked for them, with the threat of scandal and ruin pressing in on both sides. As they cannot inherit, they must marry or fall into poverty when their father dies. Mary Robinette Kowal does not try to hide that marriage is an economic arrangement between families, and that romance is a woman's way of enduring a bad situation. Melody, the beautiful sister, has no shortage of suitors. Jane, on the other hand, is cursed with a big nose and brown hair, and so no man has looked at her twice. She comforts herself with the thought that her sister's husband will take her in, though this is by no means guaranteed. The choice of detail in Shades of Milk and Honey is exquisite. Everything is described in spare, precise language, without a single wasted word or padded scene. This makes Shades of Milk and Honey a quick read. I finished most of it on the plane home from the World Fantasy Convention. In the finest romance tradition, very little actually happens until the dramatic ending. The majority of the book is concerned with the interactions between people, with word and gesture, thought and response. I found it enthralling. The aspect of the book that has gotten the most attention is its magic. Mary Robinette Kowal has made her book's magic small and subtle to avoid breaking history. This was not an easy task, and she has spoken at length about it elsewhere. The magic is called glamour, with a U, because the book is set in England, and the author has gone to great effort to use language appropriate for the time and place. Glamour, like most everything else, is considered women's work when used in the home, and men's work when done professionally. It is the art of folding the ether to produce small illusions, a dress on a mannequin, a piece of ambient music to liven a party, or an elaborate glamural that turns a room into a forest glade. Jane has a particular talent for glamour, which gets her into trouble before it gets her out of it. It does not take a genius to figure out the end of the story. Both sisters find appropriate men and live happily ever after, until the next episode. I am told that there are plans for another book, which will involve swashbuckling. I had my doubts about this book at first, but I'm glad I gave it a chance, and I can't wait for the sequel. As I mentioned before, I have just returned from the World Fantasy Convention in Columbus, Ohio. I had a great time. Never before have I been in the presence of such a concentrated pool of talent. I arrived late on Thursday and was immediately taken to the con suite, where I was fed fruit and cheese and crackers. That was off-hours fare at the con suite. For meals, they brought in catering. After I was fed, I was presented with a tote bag filled with books. This, I am told, is a world fantasy tradition. My books included Hotel Under the Sand by Cage Baker, which I had been planning to buy, as well as Warbreaker by Brandon Sanderson and Labyrinth by Pearl North, among other exciting titles. From my point of view, the convention ran flawlessly. If there were problems behind the scenes, they never affected me. The first panel I attended was Fantasy Gun Control, with panelists Walter John Williams, Charles Gannon, Elizabeth Bunce, Lee Martindale, and Ian Drury. They had a lively discussion about the lack of firearms in fantasy, by which they meant high fantasy, or sword and sorcery, or really anything that wasn't urban fantasy. It was almost the end of the panel before someone raised a hand and said, "But Harry Dresden carries a shotgun." The panelists raised a lot of good points, starting with Tolkien's experiences during the First World War and his hatred of industrialization. Because, one of the panelists said, war was such a jolly thing before the Germans ruined it with the machine gun. Another panelist brought up the Greek heroic tradition and its basis in hoplite warfare, where the job of a warrior was to stand toe to toe with another warrior and fight until somebody fell down. This effect is hard to achieve with modern firearms. Firearms can also be equalizers, which can undermine the plot of a fantasy story. Fantasy thrives on exceptionalism. Our heroes are stronger, smarter, faster, gifted with magic, possessing superhuman endurance. If some skinny girl with a 45 can kill Conan the Barbarian, the author has to find a reason why Conan is the hero and not the kid with the gun. Naturally, someone brought up Stephen King's Gunslinger. One of the panelists asked if the absence of firearms wasn't the product of the fantasy genre's focus on Europe, and wondered if fantasy based on the American Wild West might not have lots of firearms. Finally, someone brought up urban fantasy, but by then we were out of time. I attended another panel on adapting mythology for modern fantasy. Elizabeth Baer ran the panel, to my delight, and one of the more interesting parts was the discussion about cultural appropriation and why so many fantasy authors stick to angels, fairy courts, and the Olympians. The panelists identified two separate factors in this equation. First, the cultures that produced these myths no longer exist in any meaningful way, and second, Christianity is bigger than you and can stomp on you if it chooses. There is a difference between mangling the sacred stories of a small, underprivileged culture and those of a culture that dominates the Western world. The readings I attended were uniformly excellent, with one standout. If you ever, ever get a chance to attend a reading by Genevieve Valentine, go. She told us a story from her upcoming novel, Mécanique, and she had us enraptured. Friday night boasted a gigantic collective autograph session. I have never seen so many talented writers in one place at one time. It was a little overwhelming. By far the biggest draw at World Fantasy was the opportunity for networking. Whether at the parties, at the bar, or just in the hallways, the odds of meeting someone who matters in the industry is better at World Fantasy than at any other convention I've attended. It is very much a professional convention. I had no idea that's what I was getting into, but I'm glad I went. At the tour party, talking to Paolo Bacigalupi, and who shows up but John Scalzi? He gave Paolo this incredible guilt trip about missing the SIFWA meeting, and then he's like, hey, I have the SIFWA haiku here on my iPhone. And Paolo's like, cool, I'll take a picture of it with my iPhone. And Blake Charlton, he was there too. Did I forget to say that? Because he was. He was like, I can feel the singularity happening right now. So then I saw what Paolo was drinking, and I was like, dude, where did you get that? And he said, in the bathtub. And things get a little bit fuzzy after that. In addition to the huge pile of books that I was given at registration, I picked up a few on my own. One book I had been looking forward to for months, which I not only bought, but got signed, is Catherine Valenti's Habitation of the Blessed, an alternate history science fiction novel with the premise that the land described in the letter of Prester John is a real place. I am only a few chapters into this book, and I think it might be better than Palimpsest. I will have a full review once I've finished it. I picked up Mary Robinette Kowal's book, of course, the always gracious Ted Chiang's novella, The Life Cycle of Software Objects, as well as the first volume of the Tiptree collection. My luggage weighed exactly 50 pounds, because my carry-on was full of books, too. In local news, the launch of Chris McKittrick's science fiction novel, Transcendence, was a standing-room-only success. He read passages of his novel for the audience, then took questions until the bookstore people mentioned that they were closing and could he please wrap it up? Thank you to everyone who came. It's always good to see a community support its authors. The Kansas City Science Fiction and Fantasy Society will be holding its annual Thanksgiving feast on Saturday, November 20th, at 5 p.m. at the Writer's Place. Remember to RSVP and bring your own plates. The Voice of the Vortex is produced under a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivative Works, Share-alike 3.0 license. To comment on this episode, or to submit flash fiction for future shows, drop an email to thevoiceofthevortex, all one word, at gmail.com. Show notes are available at voiceofthevortex.podbean.com. This is Sarah Frost, the Voice of the Vortex, signing off.